Isaiah chapter 7. As I've been reflecting on this passage, here's one big thing that's just I'm carrying with me all week, and it's this. That the most basic truth that a person can learn, the most important truth that a person can learn during their days on this earth is that our God can be trusted. Of all the things you think you know and all the things you might want to learn and know about while you're here, this I want to put to you is the most important thing you'll ever learn, is that our God can be trusted. He is completely trustworthy. Do you agree? Now, it's easy to say, and it's particularly, it's kind of an easy thing to acknowledge when times are good. But I actually reckon we display what we really believe about whether God's trustworthy or not when things get hectic and tricky and scary and you get gripped by fear. Then you display by what you do what you really believe about God and whether you really think he's trustworthy. I want to ask you the question, where do you run when things get heavy, when things get scary? What are your tendencies? Where do you run to when push comes to shove, when the pressure's on you? Where do you go? A few years back, I saw one of those gnarly scenarios that I got to witness the whole kids running after the kitten thing. And they were chasing it down the street, and the kitten runs out onto the road, and they're beckoning the kitten to come back to them. They're chasing the kitten because they want the kitten to come back to safety, right? And it was like there was this little moment where the kitten kind of was stuck in this position. It was scared. It was confused. It didn't know what to do and had to make a decision. Am I going to turn? Am I going to run back to these people who are chasing me? or am I going to run out on the road and there's a car coming? I don't know where to go. It made the wrong decision. And the reason why I know that is because I was the one driving the car. Bit hectic. But I tell you that story because I actually think we're just like that. That's a pretty heavy story. Some of you are just freaking out. No, I'm not that freaked out. It's just a cat, right? Cats can come and go. Right? Feel bad for the kids. But when you're stuck in a confusing situation, when push comes to shove and you're scared, like animals make dumb decisions. I want to just acknowledge we do the very same thing. When people get scared, when fear grips a person, you can choose to run in stupid directions. We can make really bad decisions. What do you do when you're gripped by fear? Isaiah 7 is all about King Ahaz, gripped by fear, the pressure's on him, and we learn where not to run to. Yeah? He runs in the wrong direction. He runs away from the protection of his God. He doesn't choose to trust in God. He runs in the opposite direction, and it's an absolute tragedy. Will you dive into Isaiah chapter 7 with me and see if we can learn a lesson and reflect on ourselves and how we operate when we're under pressure? Isaiah chapter 7, let me just warm you up a little bit. What we've got here is you've got God's people who have been pulled together by God and they've been planted in God's land and they're meant to live there under God's rule. And God never wanted them to have a king because he was their king. And when they started asking him for a king, he really reluctantly said, I don't want to give you one because the minute you get a king, you're just going to want to be like all the other nations, but you're to be my people, a light to the nations, holy to me. God reluctantly lets them have a king. They have a couple of good kings, but then we get this succession of bad kings. Kings who, instead of leading the people as a man under the authority of God, so the whole nation follows God, they end up moving away from trusting God and leading the whole nation astray. What King Ahaz was meant to do here with the people was to lead all of the people to trust their God, to trust God for protection, to trust God for provision, to understand that he is their sovereign Lord and King. But King Ahaz, like many kings before him, time and time again, they lack trust in God. To dive into the actual situation that's going on here for Israel is important. You've got to get your head into it. So come to verse 1 and 2 there with me and pick up the context of what's actually going on. Why is he so scared? Why is the whole nation scared? Look at verse 1. It's really clear, really obvious, really easy to understand. Not. when Ahaz, son of Jotham, son of Uzziah, was king of Judah, King Rezin of Aram and Pekah, son of Remaliah, king of Israel, marched up to fight against Jerusalem, but they could not overpower it. Now the house of David was told, Aram has allied itself with Ephraim, so the hearts of Ahaz and his people were shaken as the trees of a forest were shaken by the wind. Got it? Good. We'll just move on from there, yeah? Now, some of you have been in this passage all week. You've figured it all out. You know who's where, what they're doing. Some of you guys are walking in fresh tonight going, what is going on here? And some of you tried to figure it out all week and you still couldn't get it because it's just confusing. I'm going to try and do it. I'm going to try and do it really simply so we get up to speed with the context of what's happening and then we can see what was gripping Ahaz with fear. Now, usually when there's nations and kings mentioned and all this kind of stuff going on, I need to look at a map. Yeah, I don't know if maps help you. Maps help me. One of the key things you can, which helps you understand all that's going on, is once you realize that there's actually only three key players in this story, but four different names are used for each of the key players. That's the confusing thing. On your sermon notes, I put those names down there on your handout. You pull that out. There's actually a sermon notes sheet in there that you can scribble on. I tried to put down there the four different names that each of those countries are given because they get used interchangeably through this section. And once you unlock that key, you can figure out what's going on. But I still need to see a map and see where people are and actually what's happening. So I looked for a map and I found lots of maps, but they're so confusing. So I made up my own map, right? I made my own map. I spent hours on it, spent lots of money on it. Are you ready to see it? You can't laugh. Here it is. All right. My whiteboard map. This is this afternoon thinking, I'm sick of all those maps. I want to draw my own. Here's what's going on in the situation. You see over on the left there, yeah, your left, there's the Mediterranean Sea, those beautiful little blue ripples over that side there. Let's work our way up from the bottom. Down the bottom there, you've got Judah. I'll put a bit of green around Judah, although you can't really see the green too well, but there's Judah down the bottom. That's the southern kingdom of God's people. The capital of Judah is Jerusalem. That's where the temple is. That's the capital city of Judah. But look over to the right. See that arrow I've put there? Judah is also called, here's its pet name, the House of David. And the king of Judah is King Ahaz. You've got to get all those four things because they all get used in different contexts. Yeah? Further north of Judah is the other chunk of God's people, which have absolutely gone astray by this time in history. There's been a civil war. The nation of God's people split in two into a southern and a northern kingdom. The northern kingdom ends up just getting called Israel. The capital of the northern kingdom is Assyria. But you can see the arrow off to the right there. The northern kingdom, Israel, is also called, here's its pet name, Ephraim. And its king is King Pekah. And he was an absolute Pekahhead, right? He's the son of Remaliah as well. Sometimes we just call him the son of Remaliah. That's what you do, right? So are you picking up where we're going with all this? You go further north and kind of over to the east of Israel, and they've got a pagan neighbor. That pagan neighbor is the nation of Assyria. The capital of Assyria is Damascus, but Assyria is also called Aram. And Aram's got the king called Rezin. Now, you with me? You with it? Further north, you can see right up the top there is Assyria. How's my picture of Assyria? Scary, yeah? The idea of me drawing Assyria like that is Assyria is a superpower of the time. There's a bunch of emerging superpowers. This is the main one, and I've drawn them in red and big and angry because superpowers just want to come down, swoop down, demolish other nations, take over nations, spread their power. And that's what everyone's scared of in this time. Everyone's scared of Assyria. What do you do when Assyria starts to get its armies up and start moving? What do all these smaller nations do? You've got to do something. You need some options. I'll tell you what's actually happening. Most of the time, the smaller nations decide to form alliances, get together, strengthen numbers, so that if Assyria does come down and attack, they can join together and actually push Assyria back. That's usually what smaller nations do. Either that or hook up with the big nation for protection. But in this context, here's what's going. You still following me? You with me? Here's what's happened. Syria and Israel decide to form an alliance so they can protect themselves against Assyria that's about to come down. Now, they're thinking, the more the merrier. Let's get Judah on board with this as well. He's not keen, but let's put a bit of pressure on him. So they decide to come down and put pressure on Judah and attempt to force Judah to join them in an alliance so they can form a big crowd of smaller nations and protect themselves from Assyria. Okay? That's what happens there in verse 1. They march down and they try to overtake Judah, put pressure on Judah to get Judah to join them, but Judah doesn't want a bar of it. Judah fights back and they can't get in and take Jerusalem. They can't get Judah to form an alliance with them. So if they can't, you know, politely get Judah to form an alliance, they're going to come back again and they're going to make this next one stronger. They're going to lay siege to the city, cut off its food and water supply, starve it out. And it actually says, you can pick it up later on in the passage, verse 5 and 6, they're actually going to come down and attempt to demolish it and put their own king in place. Rather than just trying to get them on board, they're going to come and actually demolish Judah. That's what's going on for Judah. That's what's going on for King Ahaz. He's there in Jerusalem. And we pick up there in verse 2. Read that with me now. Now the house of David was told that Aram has allied itself with Ephraim, so the hearts of Ahaz and his people were shaken, as trees in the forest were shaken by the wind. So he's scared. They've had one go at pressuring them into alliance. They've backed off. They're getting ready to come down, but now they're going to destroy them. So King Ahaz is freaking out. The whole of the nation of Judah are really scared. And when you're scared, you're tempted to do dumb things. You're tempted to run in the wrong direction. And that's exactly what King Ahaz is tempted to do and exactly what he does do. It's absolutely tragic. What are his options? His options are to either ally himself with Syria and Israel, or he's kind of already blown that chance. His other option is to actually go up and try and make an alliance with Assyria. But when you don't actually make alliances with superpowers, you actually just become a servant nation to them. It's called becoming a vassal, or you enter into a covenant with them for protection, but it comes at a huge, huge cost. That's the other option that King Ahaz, that the whole house of Judah has, is to join up with Assyria and seek protection with Assyria, which is what most people would do back in that day. But I just want to emphasize tragedy if you do that. Huge cost for doing that. The big costs are basically you become the servant. They become your boss. They can cause you to do anything they want you to do. The first thing they'll get you to do is to change the way your leadership runs the country. They'll change your national religion. They will force you to worship their pagan gods. And that would mean for Judah to basically deny God, deny Yahweh, turn its back on its king, its sovereign king, and hook up with Assyria. They're the options. Judah has one other option. And actually, this one other option, this third option, is the option that God wants them to take. It's the option that God brings to them through the prophet Isaiah. And Isaiah lays it out on the table for King Ahaz and says, here's the one. Here's the option I want you to take. It's probably the scariest one, but it's the best one. It's actually going to be the one that gives you the most amount of protection. Here is your security. Let's pick up what Isaiah says in verse 3 to King Ahaz. Then the Lord said to Isaiah, go out, you and your son, Jashub. And meet Ahaz, that's King Ahaz, at the end of the aqueduct of the upper pool on the road to the washerman's field. Just stop there for a minute. God says to Isaiah, go to King Ahaz, I want you to give him my message. But when you go, take your son named Shir Jashub. Now, if you know anything about prophets, it's not just a message they bring. Often their whole life embodies the message they bring. Sometimes even the names of their children embody the message that they bring, and that's the case here. What that name of his son means is central to the message that he's bringing to King Ahaz. And that name basically means a remnant will return or a remnant will remain. So God says to Isaiah, go take your son, an embodiment of the message that you're taking, a remnant will return. And he says, go and you'll find Ahaz in a very particular place. You'll find him at the aqueduct of the upper pool. Why is Ahaz out there at the aqueduct of the upper pool by the washman's field? Well, he's a king who's freaking out. He's freaking out that the nations are going to come down and lay siege to his city. They're going to cut off the water and the food. So he's out there checking out their water supply. He's thinking, can we somehow protect our water supply to preserve ourselves as a city? So God says, that's where you'll find him, out there freaking out, trying to do it all in his own strength, trying to save his own city, which is partly his job as a king, but that's where you'll find him. Go to him and say this, verse 4, be careful, keep calm, and don't be afraid. Don't lose heart. Can you hear the message? King Ahaz, you are freaking out. Don't do anything stupid. Calm down. Keep calm. Don't do anything dumb. And he says don't do anything dumb. And here's his reasoning. These two nations that you're so scared about, they're not going to do anything to you. They're not going to harm you at all. Have a look at how he actually brings that message to him. Where are we there? Verse 4. Yeah, there it is. Don't lose heart. Halfway through verse 4. Because these two smouldering stubs of firewood. Don't be afraid of these two smouldering stubs of firewood. In other words, Isaiah is bringing a message from God saying these two nations, Syria and Israel, you don't need to be scared of them. You don't need to fear them at all because they are like two smouldering stubs of firewood, meaning they're like what's left after a bonfire goes sweeping through. They are actually going to get taken out themselves. And they are actually nothing as a nation. You don't need to fear them. Something bad's going to happen to them before they even get down to get to you. So don't stress. Everything's going to be okay. Look down in verse 7. This is what the Sovereign Lord says. It will not take place. It will not happen. In other words, don't worry. And look at the language that he uses. For the head of Aram is Damascus, and the head of Damascus is only Rezin. Within 65 years, Ephraim too will be shattered to be a people. And verse 9, the head of Ephraim is Samaria, and the head of Samaria is only Remaliah's son. What's God saying to them? You don't need to be worried about these nations because they're just led by men. They're only men. And what's implicit in helping King Ahaz to understand that? These nations that you're scared of, they're just led by men. What's the implicit message? You, the nation of Judah, your king is the sovereign Lord of the universe. You don't need to be scared of these mere men. You have God, the Lord and King of the entire universe, as your king. Go to him for protection. Go to him for protection. I'm your king. God is saying through the prophet Isaiah to King Ahaz, trust me. Stay faithful to me. Don't run in fear. Don't put your trust elsewhere. Don't do anything stupid. And then look at the second half of verse 9. I'll put to you, this is the key verse or part of the verse for what we're looking at tonight. Here's the message. Look at it, second half of verse 9. If you do not stand firm in your faith, you will not stand at all. If you do not stand firm in your faith, you will not stand at all. So God's not simply saying to King Ahaz, look, choose the best option. He's saying, choose me or you're ruined. Put your trust in me, keep your faith in me, or you're gone as a nation and you're gone as a man. This embodies everything that we're looking at tonight. Really, God is wanting to warn King Ahaz. Warn him. It's me or it's ruin. Don't go anywhere else. And God is so keen for King Ahaz to get it, and for King Ahaz to trust him and keep the nation of Judah on the right path sitting under their sovereign king. He's almost kind of begging Ahaz to kind of put his trust in him. Have a look at what he goes on to do in verse 11. He says, ask the Lord your God for a sign, whether in the deepest depths or in the highest heights. In other words, ask me anything. I want to give you assurance here that you can trust me. I want to give you faith here that you can trust in me. I want to help you trust in me. I see how much you're struggling. I really want to help you. What does Ahaz do? How does he respond? Verse 12. But Ahaz says, I will not ask. I will not put the Lord to the test. Now, that sounds pretty godly to start with, doesn't it? Sounds like he's, oh, that's an honourable thing to say. He doesn't want to put the Lord to the test. But I say to you, it's just defiance and denial dressed up. Dressed up with godly language. And we're good at doing that sometimes, using godly language, but really what's in our heart is just defiance and denial. Really what King Ahaz is saying here is, I don't want a sign. I don't want help. I actually don't want assurance because I don't want to trust in you, Lord. I don't want to have to rely on you. Bottom line, that's what he's saying. And he's testing the Lord's patience by saying it, as you can read on to say. Now, we don't get the details of what King Ahaz actually does here in this passage, but you read 2 Kings, 2 Kings 16, scribble that down, 2 Chronicles 28, you get the details of what King Ahaz does. Let me just give you the brief overview of what he does to show that really he is defying the Lord here. What he does is he goes to the king of Assyria for protection. He breaks his covenant with Yahweh, his God, and forms a covenant relationship with the king of Assyria. It's devastating. And if you read chapter 16 of 2 Kings, it's awful what he has to do the minute he forms that relationship with the king of Assyria. He goes up and he sees how the king of Assyria, how they worship their pagan gods, and he has to bring all that design and all that worship down into Jerusalem. And he starts chucking out this altar and building a new one and getting some of the treasures from the temple that which are for Yahweh and offering them to the king of Assyria. He has to change all the worship. And some of the worship of the pagan gods of Assyria involved sacrificing your own children. And he did. He sacrificed some of his own sons. Talk about a cost. Talk about a huge cost to put your trust anywhere else. He realigns the whole nation. He sells his soul and the soul of the nation to the devil. What a fool. How does God respond when his king over his people runs in the opposite direction? When he's scared and runs in the place of towards danger instead of safety. Well, God thinks he's a fool, and he's going to judge him because of it. Have a look at verse 13. Then Isaiah said, "Hear now, you house of David. Is it not enough to try the patience of men? Will you now try the patience of my God?" Notice he's saying, "You're trying the patience of my God." He's not even going to call call God Ahaz's God anymore. He says, he's not your God. You know, if you're not putting your trust in him, he's not your God. Your God is the one you go to. Your God is the one you run to. Your God is the one you put your trust in, your faith in. Your God is the one you count on deep down. And he's saying, he's not your God. You're going to try the patience of my God? And then look at this. Verse 14, then the Lord himself will give you a sign. You don't want a sign? God's going to give you a sign anyway. You run from him, you break your side of the covenant relationship with him, he's not going to break his. He's going to give you a sign, and it's going to be a different kind of sign. It's not going to be a sign that simply says he's going to protect you, like the sign he was asking him to ask for. Am I confusing you? I think I'm confusing myself. He says, this new sign that he's going to bring is a sign with a double edge to it. It's not simply about protection now. Look at the sign. The virgin will be with child and will give birth to a son and will call him Emmanuel. Now, some of us read those verses and we jump straight to Jesus because that's what's quoted in Matthew chapter 1, which is awesome. We'll get there in just a minute. But we need to understand that all Old Testament prophecy always does find a partial fulfillment in the time that it's given. And so here's a sign that's going to be given to King Ahaz, but it's a sign that's got a double edge on it. Basically, the thing is this. There's a virgin who's going to give birth to a son. Now, in the Hebrew, the word virgin there could just literally mean young woman. There will be a maiden, a young woman, who will give birth to a son. In the New Testament, in the Greek, it's far more likely that it actually does mean virgin in the virgin kind of sense. But here in the Hebrew, it could very well be young maiden, young woman. And here's the sign. That young woman is going to give birth to a son, and that son is going to be named Emmanuel. And that sign that is given is a lot of argument about what that was in that day. What was that son? Who was the virgin? What son was it? I don't know. There's lots of different theories. The one I'd probably lean towards is to say this is probably Isaiah's wife, a young maiden, who gives birth to another son, and this son is named Emmanuel. All his sons get funky names. I would lean that way. And so this is probably another one of Isaiah's sons. But the point is this. This son will be born, and if you read on in verse 16, it says, before the boy knows enough to reject the wrong and choose the right, the land of the two kings you dread will be laid waste. In other words, before this kid even gets to about the age of three, where it knows wrong and right. In other words, in the very near future, these two nations that you're scared about are going to be taken out. And here's the thing with the sign. It's got a double edge. The first edge is still mercy. God's still going to protect them from the two nations. Verse 16 says that very clearly. Those two kings you're scared about, they will soon be laid waste. And that's exactly what happens. Assyria comes down and wipes them out completely. You know, turns them into servants of Assyria. But it's not just mercy now. There's a double edge. There's judgment as well. And when you read on from verse 17, you see the judgment that God's going to lay out on Judah. Look at verse 17. The Lord will bring on you and your people and on the house your father and on the house of your father a time unlike any seen before, it's unlike any seen since Ephraim broke away from Judah. He will bring the king of Assyria. So this sign's going to be given. God's going to give it to him, and it's going to be about mercy and about judgment. The judgment's pretty full on. If you read down what's actually going to happen, there's the Lord's going to whistle, verse 18. And those superpowers are going to be like trained insects in the hand of a sovereign God who are going to sweep down through the nation like flies and bees swarming everywhere. There'll be nowhere to hide from them. They will come and they will completely occupy all of Judah. Verse 20 tells us, this is cool language. Have a look at this with me. Verse 20, in that day the Lord will use a razor hired from beyond the river. In other words, it's like Assyria is a hired razor in the hand of the Lord because he's sovereign and he's going to bring them down. Why are they a razor? Well, they're going to shave your head and the hair off your legs, and to take off your beards also. What's that saying? It's basically saying that for men, that hair is a sign of your dignity and honor and worth. But to have your hair removed is a sign of shame, yeah? So, and I think the same applies today. What do you reckon? Hey? Hair is a sign of dignity. On your face, on your head, on your legs, for goodness sake, gentlemen. Keep hair on your legs, all right? I don't care what sport you think you're into. Keep it on your legs. It's a badge of honor. God's going to bring shame on his people by removing their men so their men are all hairless. Hairless. Forget Metro. Let's keep it hairy, men, all right? The language that sweeps down through this passage basically just rings of are people being wiped out. The population just gets brought down to just a couple of people wandering around. All the agriculture that's set up just gets decimated. The crops get wiped out. The indication there with curds and honey are not necessarily to do with abundance, more to do with the fact that every animal around ends up being killed for food and there's only one cow and two goats left. And the amount of milk they get from that one cow and two goats is an abundance, meaning there mustn't be many people around that they've got to turn some of the milk into curds. It's basically saying, you know, this is severe depopulation of an area, massive judgment. The people have been wiped out. It might even be a little bit of sarcasm on the whole land of milk and honey. Yeah, you're going to get milk and honey, but that's about all. Just curdles of milk and honey because you're going to be decimated. There's going to be a huge amount of judgment. But notice in that as well, in the judgment, there's a remnant. There's a small group of people who survive. There's the mercy. Despite them as a nation breaking the covenant with their God and getting hooked up with Assyria and defying God, he will give them a sign. He will preserve in them a remnant. The big thing that keeps kind of ringing out of this passage all week for me is this. It's just thinking into the concept of, as we see King Ahaz fearing, trembling in fear, and making a decision where he's going to run. I can't help it. This is what we need to think into. Because fear makes you do dumb things. It makes you run in the wrong direction. And when I use that word fear and being scared, sometimes as blokes we go, I'm not scared. I'm not scared of nothing. I don't have fear because we're tough and we're blokey. Think about the kind of things that make you angry and frustrated. At the base of those things are your fears. You might know what your fears are. You might know what your things are that make you really scared. I want to say to you tonight, be careful. Be very, very careful. Stay calm. What are your fears? Are you aware of them? I want to throw a few out there. You might be single, and your greatest fear might be, I'm just always going to be alone. And from that fear, I want to encourage you, be careful. Be careful, because your temptation may be to think, I'm just going to find someone, anyone. It doesn't matter who they are. It doesn't matter whether they're wanting to honor the Lord with their life, and I'm just going to find someone rather than to trust God and to just wait to see if God brings you someone who is keen to honor him with their life as well. Trust him. Don't do anything stupid. Wait on him. You might be married, but your biggest fear might be this, that you think, I've married the wrong one. I've married the wrong person. This person is not fulfilling the hopes and dreams that I had for my life. They're not doing anything like what I pictured would be my wonderful life of happiness. And it may be that you're tempted to be thinking, and even right now, I'm just going to give up on this one. Perhaps fully give up and walk away, or even just emotionally give up and write them off and just think, oh, I'm just not going to give any more to this relationship. Rather than trust God. Trust him that he lives in you by his Spirit and is completely able to give you the grace that you need to love them sacrificially and press on in relationship. I say this to the exclusion of those of you who are in abusive relationships. You're not called to trust God and pursue and remain in a relationship where you are being abused. That's the exception. But everything else, you trust God. What's your fear? You might have kids, and your greatest fear might be that they just might not do well enough, that they might not make it. And by make it, you might mean, what if they're just no happier than I was as I grew up? What if they don't get any more opportunities than I had? Your greatest fears may be caught up in your kids. And if that's the case, you might be tempted to just frantically run around trying to get your kids involved in every program, every sport, every course, to give them every opportunity so they could be everything that you want them to be for your glory, rather than to simply just trust God and think that your major role as a parent is to worship God and honor God so that your kids see that and understand that that's what matters and they know what it means. I don't claim to be a parenting expert, but I just want to throw that one out there. I'll give you one more. It may be that you're in that moment in your life where your biggest fear is, my life's disappearing. You're having one of those midlife crises. And apparently you can have them from 25 onward these days. You can have them whenever you want. Midlife crisis. It's apparently that point. I'm not there yet. It's that point where you're going through life going, yeah, it's all ahead of me. And then all of a sudden you get to that point where you're like, you're joking. It's actually all behind me. All that time I had to live that life, it's all, and you panic. You know, people in their midlife crisis are fearing that they haven't done enough yet, haven't seen enough yet, haven't owned enough yet, haven't changed enough yet, haven't become who I desperately wanted to be. And in your fear, in your midlife crisis, and you think, I haven't achieved the significance that I dreamt up for myself in my work and in my finances, in my relationship. I'm not there yet. You can run out and you can panic and you make a mad dash to spend yourself on a variety of things that don't matter one iota for the kingdom and all eternity. But you see people doing it, spending themselves on all these ridiculous things. That might be you. If that's your fear, trust God. Don't do anything stupid. Press into the simple, humble, obedient life that aims to honor God and not necessarily make a big splash and leave the world a better place. Just honor God. Simple, humble, below the radar. You might be desperately thinking, I think I'm missing out on the best life. Tempted to run everywhere else but God. Trust Him. Go to Him. Security in Him, protection in Him, life in Him. When Jesus says, come and follow me, He tells us there's going to be a cost, huge cost. There's going to be suffering, there's going to be sacrifice, but ultimately you are going to get life, life to the full, because you're going to know me. You're going to know me, you're going to know who your God is. You're actually going to be secure in your God and here now, and you're going to know what the future holds for you. That's life to the full. What is your fear right now? Do you know what your fears are? Do you know what you tend to panic about? Be careful. Be careful of this. Whatever you run to in the place of God will one day turn and crush you. Whatever you run to in the place of God will one day turn and crush you, just like it did for King Ahaz. He runs to Assyria. Assyria ultimately crushes him and wipes him out. There is one secure place for life. There is one person who can be fully trusted. There is one being in whom life exists. One place to run. It's God. Go to Jesus. I'll finish on this. The sign that for them was a young maiden having a baby, naming it Emmanuel, meaning judgment and mercy in their time. I'm calling you and reminding myself that in times of fear that we need to run to God because He is trustworthy. Whatever you fear, He's trustworthy. Run to Him. The sign for us that He is trustworthy and that we can put our faith in Him is this sign. It's the fulfillment of this sign, the Emmanuel sign. We pick it up in Matthew chapter 1. It's the virgin, but not just a young maiden, an actual virgin, the fulfillment, the completion of this prophecy. The Virgin Mary gives birth to a son, the boy Jesus, who is named Emmanuel and is actually Emmanuel. He is actually God with us. He is the eternal, divine, sovereign Lord, King of the universe, come in bodily form to live among us, to live a perfect life on our behalf, and then to go to the cross and die a wrath-absorbing death on the cross, and then rise again to new life and turn to us and say, there is the sign, I am trustworthy, run to me. For protection, run to me for security, run to me for life. I am trustworthy. I want to wrap up tonight by just giving you a bit of time to reflect. And I'm hoping that either I've touched on some of your fears here or I've sparked things that have got you thinking about your fears and being willing to acknowledge what your fears are and where you're tempted to run. We've got a huge encouragement that the only place to run is to God. It's the only safe place.